Now, if you like to turn to the book of Numbers, and we come to the fourth book in the Bible, and the fourth book of Moses, the book of Numbers. We're going to try once again to do a survey of this whole book in just one talk. Now, this book of Numbers is so called because it starts with a census, with a counting of the children of Israel. And again in chapter 26, there's another command from God to number or count the children of Israel. So that's how it comes to be called the book of Numbers. It really is the story of the journeying of Israel from Mount Sinai to Kadesh, and then from Kadesh to Kadesh. What do you mean, from Kadesh to Kadesh, that's right. Eventually, well, they went round in circles, just like my tongue was doing then. They went round in circles for 38 years. And then the last part is from Kadesh to the plains of Moab. You see, in the book of Exodus, we saw the journey of the children of Israel from captivity in Egypt to Mount Sinai, where they were going to meet with God. And then in the book of Leviticus, we were looking at some of the laws which God gave to them, and the different kinds of laws, especially the laws relating to sacrifice, and especially the laws relating to being pure in every way, including hygienically pure. But now, although the book of Numbers has some laws passages in it, it takes up the narrative again, the story again, of Israel's journey. Now, many people have maps at the back of their Bible, and one of the maps is often a picture of the Sinai Peninsula with the Red Sea on one side and the Gulf of Aqaba on the other side, and it shows the journeying of the children of Israel. But in actual fact, nobody is terribly sure of the place names which are mentioned in the book of Numbers. We're fairly sure that Mount Sinai was the one down in the south at the tip of the triangle, and that they went down there alongside of the Red Sea, but then they journeyed north again on their way to the Promised Land, which we know as the Holy Land or Palestine. But they stopped before they got there and wandered for a long time until eventually they entered it from the eastern side, north of the Dead Sea. But just where they went to during their time of wandering, well, nobody can be really accurate and sure. They just wandered around in that wilderness. But the book of Numbers is also a story about grumbling. Israel were always grumbling. But it's also a story of God's patience and God's faithfulness, and we'll come back to that at the very end. Now, I've put a kind of an outline again on the board for those who can see it, and obviously we can't go in detail into everything. The first four chapters deal with the numbering and the marshalling together of the tribes of Israel ready to move off from Mount Sinai, where they have been receiving the Ten Commandments and where they've been receiving the civil laws and the religious laws, the ordinances, where they have made and erected the tabernacle, where they have been told about the priests and the Levites. They've been there for about a year and a great deal has happened to them there. But now they're ready to move off and they're going to take a census. Verse 2 of chapter 1, take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel by families, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male, so you're only to count the men, head by head. So if any haven't got heads, you don't count them. But every male from 20 years old and upward, so you don't count those in their teens and below, and all who are able to go forth to war, they must be able-bodied and ready for military service. And to help you, Moses and Aaron, verse 4, you'll have a man from each tribe to make sure they're counted correctly. Now the tribes were as follows: Reuben, Simeon, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Asher, Gad, and Naphtali, who were the sons of Jacob, and Ephraim and Manasseh, who were the sons of Joseph. So there was no tribe of Joseph. Instead, both his sons gave names to tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. And the tribe of Levi wasn't counted as one of the tribes because they had special duties in the tabernacle with the religious worship. So that made up the 12, not counting Levi. And that's how they were going to be ordered. Now I will leave you to do your homework, perhaps, and boys and girls, you might like to do this because you'll be bored with your long summer school holiday. Well, this is something you can do. Find out which was the biggest tribe and which was the smallest. Not now, but maybe at home. And the total came to 603,550. And that was males, as we've seen, over 20 years of age. So therefore that would suggest that the total population was between 2 and 3 million. And that's a lot of people. So much so that some have wondered if there was something wrong with the figuring, with our translations of the numbers, and various scholars have tried various devices to renumber them. But they haven't been terribly successful. And that's what the Bible says, and there we must leave it at the present time with our present knowledge. Now the Levites weren't numbered in that census, but they were numbered later on in a different way. And also in these chapters it speaks about the camp and how they were to be encamped. The tabernacle was always to be erected in the middle, and then the Levites' tents were to be erected round about the tabernacle or tent of meeting, and the priests were to be near the door to guard the door, and then various tribes were told exactly where they had to pitch their tent, so that if you could have flown over the camp in a helicopter, you would have seen them all neatly arranged in rows. Just like if you go up a mountain and look down on a boys' brigade camp or something, a big camp or an army camp, it's all done in an orderly fashion. And each one was allotted a place. And this reminds us that God is a God of order and not a God of chaos. And this is what we're told in the New Testament. God is not a God of confusion, but of order. He likes things done decently and in order still. And so he gave them their instructions. Now chapters 5 to chapter 9 speak of other instructions rather than numbering and marshalling and who was to carry what. In those earlier chapters they were told who was to carry which parts of the tabernacle and so on, and how it was to be taken down and how it was to be put up again. But now in chapters 5 to 9 we have some various other instructions. For instance, in chapter 5 we have a very strange chapter about jealousy and the law of jealousy, and how to detect whether a person's accusations are true or not, especially against his wife. And then in chapter 6 it begins with instructions about a special vow. The Lord said to Moses, chapter 6, 1, verse 2 now, "Say to the people of Israel, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord." Well, what shall he do? Well, if he takes this special vow, becomes a special person, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. Number one, he shall drink no vinegar, Don't know whether he'd want to, but he mustn't anyway. Made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes fresh or dried. Verse 5 is the next instruction. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall come upon his head. So if a person took a Nazarite vow, he usually had long hair. There's a lot of young men these days who've taken Nazarite vows. As you walk around, you see them. And they have long hair. Now, usually the Nazarite vow was only for a certain period. And then once his period of time was complete, he had his hair cut. But Samson took a Nazarite vow, and he was never to have his hair cut. He was to have this vow all his life. And you remember the story of Samson. We'll come to it in a future book. And then verse 6 onwards, he was to separate himself in a special way from contamination. The Nazarite vow. Rather a strange thing, that. And at the end of chapter 6 in Numbers, we have the lovely blessing of Aaron. Moses to Aaron. And this is how Aaron is to bless the people. Verse 24 of chapter 6 of Numbers. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. A lovely blessing. We probably use it on Sunday morning when a baby is dedicated to the Lord here. That's chapter 6. And then chapter 7 is the consecration of the tabernacle. We haven't time to read all about it. You can do so at home. Chapter 8, the consecration of the Levites. And then in chapter 9, they are to instruct you to get ready to depart. They're going to move off now from Sinai. And they are to celebrate the Passover feast. Of course, they're to do that every year. They did so there at Mount Sinai. And then verse 15 of chapter 9. On the day that the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of testimony. And at evening it was over the tabernacle like the appearance of fire until the morning. So it was continually. The cloud covered it by day, and the appearance of fire by night. Whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tent, after that the people of Israel set out. And in the place where the cloud settled down, there the people of Israel encamped. So they were guided by the cloud. Pillar of cloud by day and pillar of fire by night. And when it stopped, they stopped. And they erected their camp according to the instructions in the early chapters. And that's why in the hymn, Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah, the hymn writer has that. Let the fiery, cloudy pillar lead me all my journey through. Because in that hymn, which we shall sing later on, in that hymn, he's picturing our pilgrimage to heaven like their pilgrimage to the promised land. Chapter 10 to chapter 14 is their journey from Sinai to Kadesh. I can say it now. Sinai to Kadesh. Chapter 10, verse 11. First of all, verses 1 to 11 gives instructions about blowing the trumpets and when the trumpets are to be blown. And then verse 11, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, and the people of Israel set out by stages from the wilderness of Sinai, and off they went. And then it tells you about the tribes who went in front. Judah went in front, the tribe of Judah, and the tribe of Dan brought up the rear. And then we have a very nice passage in verse 29 of chapter 10 where Moses encourages his father-in-law to go with them. We are setting out for the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will do you good, for the Lord has promised good to Israel. What a lovely text to preach on. to the unconverted, we're going to the promised land. God has promised good to his people. Come with us. Come and join us, for God will do us good. I'm afraid God's people in chapter 11 were not rejoicing in God. They were grumbling for meat. They're murmuring and grumbling because they hadn't any meat. Let's take it up from verse 4. Now the rabble, says the RSV, that was among them had a strong craving. And the people of Israel all wept again and said, "Oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt for nothing." Evidently, the Egyptians gave them free food to make them strong slaves. They didn't give them any wages, though. But all they could think of was the handouts they used to get. The cucumbers and the melons, the leeks, the onions and the garlic. There are some things there that I wouldn't miss, but they missed them. And then verse 6, "But now our strength is dried up." That wasn't true. "And there is nothing at all but this manna to look at." God's food that he gave them. At first, when God had given it to them, they rejoiced and thought it was the most wonderful thing they'd ever tasted. Bread of heaven. But now they were bored with it and they grumbled. And when Moses, verse 10, heard the people weeping, he was very angry. And he knew that the anger of the Lord blazed hotly. And poor old Moses feels the burden of having to put up with this complaining people. "Ooh, we've got nothing but manna. Wish we were back in Egypt with all those lovely leeks and garlics and onions and things." And they weren't satisfied. And I think there's a lesson in that for us, you know. There are some Christians who are not satisfied with Bible study. God will feed his people on his word week by week. It's the manna of heaven. But some people don't want that. They want the things of the world brought into the church. They want the garlics and the onions and the fish that they used to have in Egypt, in the world, when they were slaves and in bondage. Now they're bored with Bible study. They want signs and wonders. They want things that titivate their palates, and they say, "Oh, Bible study's dull. The shorter the better." And they murmur against God. God is angry with his people when thus they speak of his word and the food which he has given to Christians to build us up. Well, elders were appointed to help Israel, to help Moses in the burdens which he carried and to stand with him. But God said, "I'll give them meat to eat. I'll give it to them till it's coming out of their ears. And it will make them sick." And if you read the chapter through, you'll find that's exactly what happened. It made them sick. Sick unto death, literally. And then in chapter 12, we read that even Miriam and Aaron rebelled against Moses. Miriam was his sister and Aaron was his brother. But even they began to murmur against him. They criticized him for a marriage which he'd entered into. But it wasn't really that that was their real complaint. They didn't like the authority which he had. Why shouldn't God speak through them as well as through Moses? They wanted his authority and his position. And Moses said nothing. Verse 3 of chapter 12. "Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all men that were on the face of the earth." He wouldn't defend himself against their hurtful criticisms. But they should never have criticized the Lord's anointed or objected to him having been chosen to be in authority and to be a mouthpiece for God. God has had a special relationship with Moses. It says he spoke to Moses mouth to mouth, made himself known to him in a very real way. And God called Moses and Miriam and Aaron to the tabernacle. And the glory of the Lord in the cloud came down, and when it had gone, Miriam was covered from the top of her head to the soles of her feet with leprosy. And it was Moses that pleaded for her. What a marvelous man he was. And God said, well, put her outside the camp for 7 days and then she'll be all right. And she was taken back in. And then in chapter 13 and chapter 14, we read of how they came to Kadesh and sent spies out to look at the new land and to see how it was. 12 spies, one from every tribe. And they came back with a marvelous report. They'd never seen such a place. They'd been in the wilderness, but this was a land flowing with milk and honey. Verse 23 of chapter 13. They came to the valley of Eshcol. They cut down from there a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between two of them. They brought also some pomegranates and figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol, or Cluster, because of the cluster which the men of Israel cut down. Now, I've been to Israel, and I've seen that valley, and I've seen that place, and the vines lay on the ground, because the grapes that grow on them are so big, they're like tennis balls. Have you ever seen grapes like tennis balls? They're like tennis balls, such beautiful grapes. And they can't have them upright. They have them laying down on the ground. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. The Israelis now. There. Luscious fruit. And when these spies went into that place, they picked the biggest with big grapes like big tennis balls on. And they tied it, one cluster of grapes, to a pole. And they carried it between them. And they brought it back to show everybody what they'd found there in the promised land. And the Israeli tourist board has taken this as their sign. And on all official cars, tourist cars and everything, there is this little motif of two men with a pole with a big cluster of grapes between it. We didn't go at the right time of the year. I think all we got was unleavened bread or something, wasn't it? But anyway, that's the kind of place it was. But unfortunately, they said, there are some snags. There are big fortified cities with high walls and big armies. And there are big men. They'd come across some giants, the Nephilim. We don't know quite who they were. They're referred to in Genesis chapter 6. And don't look up it now. I'm going to deal with it at Talkback with the YPF next time. But there seems to have been a line of giants. Maybe Goliath was one of the last left, and somebody put paid to him that we've been learning about. But the big fellows, and they saw some of these. And they said, oh, there are giants in the land, and we're just like grasshoppers. We can't take it. And two of the spies, Joshua and Caleb, said, well, all that's true, but we can still take it, God will give us the victory. But the other 10 said, oh no, it's useless. And in chapter 14 we read some incredible words. Verse 2, all the people of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt. They'd rather have stayed in Egypt. Or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why does the Lord bring us into this land to fall by the sword? Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? And then they said, verse 4, let's choose another captain instead of Moses and go back to Egypt. And Moses and Aaron were horrified with what they heard. Verse 10, but all the congregation said to stone them with stones. But God was very angry. And it says that God threatened to do away with the whole people and to start again with Moses. And who was it that went and pleaded for the people? Moses. Moses, who had just been threatened with stoning by these very people, and who were threatening to get another captain and lead them back to Egypt and so on. Moses goes to God and says, how can you think of such a thing, O Lord, to wipe out your people? If you did that, wouldn't the Egyptians laugh? To put it in modern terms, if you like, wouldn't the devil seem to have the victory? Because you said that you would take the people out from Egypt and you would take them to a promised land, and you promised that. But if you wipe them out, then they'll say that the Lord God Jehovah doesn't keep his promises. Do you know that is a right and proper way to pray, to plead the promises of God? It's not arguing with God or being rude to God. Some people would call it wrestling with God. Or you can say it's opening your Bible, seeing what the Bible teaches, and then asking God to fulfill his promise for the glory of his name, for he is faithful. And God said, yes, I am faithful, and I will keep my promise, and the Egyptians shall not scoff. But this generation shall not enter the promised land, it will be the next generation. All those over 20 years of age who came out of Egypt shall not get into the promised land. It shall be the young people's fellowship and the covenanters and the boys in the junior church and the beginners and the primary. When they grow up, they will enter the promised land. And those 10 spies shan't enter, just Joshua and Caleb, they would enter. And so they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years instead of going straight up into the promised land. Now chapter 15, there are various laws, and you'll have to read them at home. And then chapter 16 and 17, we read about Korah's rebellion. What, another rebellion? Yes, another rebellion. Korah, who was a Levite, and another two fellows who were brothers, verse 1, Dathan and Abiram, and another chap called On. They took men. They rose up against Moses with about 250 other leaders of the congregation, and they said, why should Moses be our leader? And why should Aaron keep the priesthood to himself? God is with us. We're going to have a coup. But God vindicated those whom he had originally chosen. And if you read the story, you will read how that God, through Moses, told all people to get away from the tents of these particular men and their families. And suddenly there was a rumbling and a sound and an earthquake and a trembling, and the ground opened up and the whole lot fell in through the ground and were never seen again. And these 250 who'd taken incense and who were near the temple were burned up with fire and they were never seen again. And Aaron put his rod in the temple, in the tabernacle, and one from each of the tribe put a rod in the tabernacle, and the following day Aaron's rod had become alive. It turned into something that sprouted and bore fruit to indicate that God had chosen Aaron. Aaron's rod that budded. There in Numbers. Alright, chapters 18 and 19, various laws. Chapter 20, Moses sins at Meribah. Moses sins? Yes, Moses sins. Even Moses' patience eventually gave out. The people were murmuring and grumbling again because they didn't have any water this time. They'd had that trouble before. But God didn't tell Moses this time to take his rod and strike the rock. He told him to speak to a rock and water would come forth. But Moses lost his temper, and he gathered the children of Israel together, verse 10, before the rock, and he said, hear now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water out of the rock? And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock, and water came out, abundantly, flowing water, still there now, flowing. But God rebuked his servant Moses, because he should have had faith to speak to the rock. He should have done it the way God told him to do it. And because of that, Moses was told he would never enter the promised land, though he would see it. And Aaron never entered the promised land. He died before they got there. It may seem hard, but those to whom much is given will much be required. And those who hold office in the Church of Jesus Christ have a very high responsibility before God. But God nevertheless gave water out of the rock, and that puzzles some people. But the answer is this: if God has promised to do something, he'll do it, even if the method is wrong and the motive is wrong. There are some methods of evangelism which are wrong. At least they're not in accord with the scriptures. And sometimes the motives for the preaching of the gospel is not pure. But yet, the Lord has said, if the pure gospel is preached, he will honour his message and he will save sinners by it. And he does. And he does. But that doesn't mean that wrong methods are right or that wrong motives are right. Chapter 21, moving around. The story of the serpents that bit them and Moses' intervention. And Moses told, verse 9, to make a bronze serpent and set it up on a pole. And if a serpent bites anyone, he's just to look at the bronze serpent up on the pole and he will be healed. And Jesus Christ said, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up. And that's a type, it's a picture of the fact that if any sinner who's been bitten by the serpent Satan and is in bondage to him and is dying will look unto Jesus, lifted up, he shall be healed of his sin and shall be saved. Chapters 22 to 24 tell the amazing story of Balaam's ass, Balaam's donkey. I'll just mention it very briefly. Israel was on the march now, coming to the end of their time, ready to enter the promised land. Now, instead of defeat, it's victory, and they're going up the eastern side of the Dead Sea and they're conquering all before them. The new generation has risen. The primary and the junior church and the covenanters have now grown up, and now they're conquering all before them. They have faith. And the king of Moab was scared, and he knew that many miles away in a town on the edge of the Euphrates there was a man called Balaam who could put curses on people. So he sent for him to come and put a curse on the marching tribes of Israel. And Balaam consulted God. Strange that he seems to have had some acquaintance with the living God. And God told him not to go, so he didn't go. So Balak, the king of Moab, sent some other emissaries and promised him gold and silver and all sorts of things. So he set off. And he was riding on the donkey. And as he was riding on the donkey, the angel of the Lord stood in the way, but Balaam, the soothsayer, couldn't see the angel of the Lord, but the donkey did. And the donkey stopped. So Balaam gave it a clout. He smacked it one with his stick to make it get going, but it didn't. It went off down a vineyard and down a field, and it was a bit out of control because it had been afraid. And then it was hemmed in between two walls, between two vineyards, and the angel of the Lord stood in the way again. And it stopped. And in stopping and veering out of the way, it crushed poor old Balaam's leg against the wall. So he gave it another smack. And he got very cross with it. And then it went on a little bit further until it couldn't pass at all. So it lay down. A bit stubborn. And now Balaam was very angry indeed. So he gave it a third smack with his stick. Whereupon, you know the story? Whereupon the donkey turned round and said, how many more times are you going to keep smacking me, and why? Now, that's not the greatest miracle to me in the story. The greatest miracle to me in the story is that Balaam says, because you won't keep going or something. I mean, if a donkey talked to me, come to think of it, a few donkeys have talked to me. But if a donkey talked to me, I think I'd be rather taken aback. But perhaps if you're a soothsayer, well, you don't. Anyway, he answered. But then God gave him to see the angel of the Lord. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he arrived. And instead of cursing Israel, he blessed them. God made him do so. He blessed them. Three times he blessed them. The king of Moab was very angry. And he said, I told you to curse them. Why have you blessed them?
And those poems of blessing are there in the Bible, in the book of Numbers. And some of them, the last one especially in chapter 24, contains some remarkable predictions. Chapter 25, I'm sad to say, is about idolatry. And Balaam the soothsayer led it. He enticed the people into idolatry and immorality with the Moabites. And he was judged for it. Chapter 26, they took another census. And they counted 601,730, almost as many as they'd counted when they came out of Egypt. Just about as many, not the same number, but nearly as many. Chapter 27 to chapter 36, various instructions. A successor to Moses must be chosen, since Moses isn't going to enter the promised land, and Joshua is to be the successor. Reuben and Gad, two tribes, choose to stay on the other side of the Jordan and not enter the promised land, but they promise that they will help fight to possess the land, but they will settle in Transjordania, and they did. The end of the book speaks of the division of the land, how it shall be divided when they enter to some extent, and various other laws, which I'll leave you to read at home. The message of the book of Numbers is surely, first of all, of the sin of grumbling. How good God had been to this people in bringing them out of Egypt and providing for their needs, and yet they grumbled, 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 rebelled, rebelled, rebelled. And God had to chastise them and judge them. And we are sometimes like that. The message of the book of Numbers is the folly of unbelief. If only they'd had faith, they could have entered that blessing 38 years before they did, or more than 38 years before they did. And maybe we are not entering into some blessing that God wants for us and has promised us and will give to us because of our unbelief. But thirdly, and most important of all, the book of Numbers' message is the faithfulness and the patience of God with his people.